This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hello, everybody. I'm David Frangione. Welcome to a very special Happy New Year pop-up podcast with my co-host, Billy Amendola, featuring the one and only and January's cover feature, Mr. Steve Jordan. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, guys. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Even better now. Woke up to Georgia being blue. I mean, come on. I feel good.
It's a good thing. Well, here's the new issue. And we're proud and honored always to have you on the cover of our magazine. So, and, you know, I listened to the Beat Odyssey a couple of times. And, you know, thank you for doing that because you put the drums in the forefront, which is perfect for drummers. And even with DJ Mike, and it's a pretty cool way to express yourself with just rhythms and drums and samples.
Well, it was a very, it was a natural type of thing. It wasn't really a lot of premeditation involved. I started working with Mike several years ago as the musical director for the Emmys. Michael Bearden turned me on to Mike. I had known about, his work, you know, with the Beastie Boys and so on and so forth. But I'd never worked with him. And Michael had worked with him on a Kennedy Center award show, which I was not involved in. This is after my stint with the Kennedy Center. And Mixmaster Mike was the DJ on the Herbie Hancock segment. And Michael and said, man, we gotta work with Mike, because I had implemented a DJ the year before in the Emmy Orchestra, and he was very good and everything. But when Mike said, oh, you should check out Mixmaster Mike, so I said, absolutely. So the first rehearsal, it was just so outstanding, and Mike's energy, Mixmaster Mike's energy was so incredible, and he was doing things that I'd never heard a turntablist do. And in addition to his musical depth, it was a match made in heaven. We just started doing stuff immediately, not like we had to work into it. It was like just add water and boom.
Yeah, because
so, you know, we wrote a couple. Yeah,
it sounds like you guys had fun. Like you hear the fun coming right out, pouring right out. The creativity, you know, like you say, it feels like you guys just clicked and then just started to play and then hit record and there you go.
Yeah, that's basically exactly what happened. We were doing some work. We were working in the orchestra and then, you know, I was writing some cues. And then I thought, well, maybe Mike and I could come up with some cues for a couple of video packages. And we did a few of those, and then we just said, why don't we just do more of this? And we just started doing it. And we did some stuff over at Capitol, and then we found a nice little studio called Sage and Sound, which doesn't exist anymore. It went out of business this year. Somebody bought the building. It's tragic, actually, because it's a nice little studio. I think it was built in the early 70s or something. And it was just perfect. It was like a perfect studio for us. And Chris Steffen was our engineer, and he did an outstanding job. And we just went in there and we started banging out some stuff. We had done a session before at Capitol with my friend Frank Wolf as an engineer. Was a great engineer. You know, it just took off. You know, it just kept rolling. You know, that's all I can say. It just kept rolling.
Yeah, and, it's very cool. It's very cool.
And then all of a sudden we had all this music. And we still may do some of that, you know, but it felt like a score, you know. It felt like, you know, like, you know, in fact, we had done a couple of film cues for a film that that never came to fruition. But, you know, that's how we're looking at it, you know, because it's all cinematic and so thematic.
Yeah, there's a lot of color in all of those. Yeah. It's a lot of color, and it could fit into a lot of, you know, commercials, TV spots, movies, without a doubt. And it's all drums, mostly all rhythm. So that's of course what our audience and what we love. But the average person could also groove to it, and it's, you know, it's catchy enough with the samples coming in, musical samples coming in and out. It's cool. It's very cool.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is you know, when people hear it, it's so visual that they don't think of it as just drums or whatever. You don't even know what's going on, you know. It's like that, and that's how we looked at it while we were doing it. It was exploration, very much, you know, kind of how jazz is improvisation, and that's basically what we did. You know, we improvised. And not a lot of premeditated stuff. We would just say, you know, let's do something in this groove, or let's do something with this BPM, or I feel like this kind of vibe, you know. And most of the time, we didn't even say that much. But, right. you know, that's like the extent of our conversation.
That's cool, though, because you can feel that. You know, you feel the energy, you feel the fun. You can see the creativity taking a path and, you know, flowing. It's cool. So let's, I know there was so much to cover. Ken McAuliffe did a fantastic job.
Ken is great. And I love talking with Ken. And I love the fact that Ken loved the record so much. It was fun to talk about because he broke it down and he could hear certain influences and stuff. And that was a lot of fun to talk about, you know.
Yeah, no, that was an excellent interview. But I know we got a really nice letter from you that we're going to publish in a couple of issues down the line, the next working issue. But we wanted to just clear up one or two things, right? We say, I think Ken thought you said Phil's music studio, but it's actually Bill's, correct?
Yeah, it was Bill's Music Rentals, and Bill was great. I wanted to clarify that. He was a great cat. I worked for him when I was in high school, at the High School of Music and Art. I would work in the percussion cage at Bill's Music Rentals. And Bill's Music Rentals was, before there was studio instrument rentals, there was Bill's Music Rentals. They supplied instruments, all the Broadway shows, and Ed Sullivan show, and you know, you name it, they provided instruments. And I worked in a percussion cage to maintain all the percussion instruments that were going out to all the theaters in Broadway, and on Broadway rather. So that was a great learning experience. I got to set up rooms. That's how I met people like Dave Sanborn and the Brecker brothers and Idris Muhammad and Roberta Flack. And of course, that's where I met Stevie Wonder. So, wow. And so it was all of that. You couldn't pay me enough to work there. You know, what an education, you know.
I was going to say that was your schooling. That was your school.
It was unbelievable. It's kind of like, I always thought about, it was on 52nd Street. right across the street from where SIR ended up being.
Wow.
And in fact, SIR, that building at SIR, it used to be a club called the Cheetah. And so I don't know if any of your friends that are older than you remember, that was a very popular club with live music in the late 60s, early 70s, the Cheetah. And I think it went out of business probably around 72 or whatever, and then SIR took it over and turned it into a rehearsal state complex and music rentals.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and I know when you're doing interviews, sometimes, you know, it's hard to get everything in and to think of everything, but there was a couple of people that you wanted to mention that had a huge influence on you that we didn't get a chance to give a shout out to. So do you want to give a shout out?
When Ken was breaking down who he thought influenced certain beats or whatever, and that was really cool, and that was a lot of fun. Obviously, everybody knows what kind of influence Ringo has on me. Tony Williams and blah, blah, blah. But there were a couple of people that weren't mentioned that are extremely important in my playing. And that's the late, great Grady Tate, the great Elbert Woody Woodson, who played with Otis Redding's live band for years, and played on some of Otis's live recordings. He was a huge influence at a certain point. When I first really got into his playing, I didn't realize that he had influenced me before I knew who he was. He played drums on the Isley Brothers' It's Your Thing, which is a record that I played. I played that record over and over again till I played the black off of that record. It was gray by the time I was done with that freaking thing. So anyway, it's a huge influence on me. And then, you know, right around the time we were talking about, toward like 1975, 76, I met Steve Ferroni when I was playing, at this club McKell's, and he had come over with Average White Band, and I loved the way he played with AWB, and so I ended up playing in a band that he played with when he was in the UK. These guys, Dick Morrissey, Jim Mullen, and Dick Morrissey. You know, there was a Scottish connection with the guys from AWB and these two guys, and so they came over, and I was playing in that band, and we opened for AWB once in Central Park. I'll never forget it.
Wow.
And I played Steve's Gretsch drums and everything, but Steve is a great friend, and I love the way Steve plays, and he's carved out an amazing career, obviously, and so he was around, and I loved the way he played. You know, one of the things I loved what Steve did, he and Anthony Jackson and Hamish, when they played with Chaka Khan under Reef Martin's direction, and with some of Chaka's solo work, which was really fantastic. So I wanted to give Steve a shout out because I love Steve.
Yes, yeah, Steve is great.
And Al, you know, people like Al Foster and, you know, Ben Reilly. Even I wasn't even a big Ben Reilly fan that much until I went back with Sonny Rollins, and I wanted to rediscover bebop drumming in a way that was more unique, just more kind of suitable for the role I wanted to play with Sonny. I've been playing with Sonny off and on for 30 years. And when I rejoined Sonny in 2005, the band was Bob Cranshaw and Bobby Broom and Kamadi Denizulu and Clifton Anderson and Sonny. And we kind of came up with a sound, but it was when I really dug in, I went back to the woodshed and listening to stuff that I had listened to for years. And of course, Philly Joe. I listened to a lot of Philly Joe again and kind of rediscovered Philly Joe. But I love the way Ben Reilly played with Monk, and I wanted to implement some of that style, you know. And, you know, it's like Kenny Clark school, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. Yeah. And even Jimmy Cobb, you know, that kind of thing. Jimmy Cobb taught my late cousin, Jimmy Jackson Jr., who died tragically from an asthma attack when his career was just taking off. But he was taught by Jimmy Cobb. So I used to always hear about Jimmy Cobb all the time. And of course, we know Jimmy's legendary playing on Kind of Blue. So, you know, people like that. And of course, Jack DeJohnette has a huge influence on my playing. And there's so many people from Sandy McGee and Cold Bloods, you name it. I could go on and on and on, obviously. Talk about Carlton Barrett, and you know, there's so many.
Who is players. Tell us a little bit about Mickey Roker, because I wasn't familiar.
Mickey Roker. Oh Lord, Mickey Roker's from Philly. Mickey Roker was one of the baddest drummers I've ever heard in my life. Oh my God, he could swing. He and Bob Francher were very tight, and they had a serious pocket together. But Mickey Roker was bad. He could swing. He was funky. You know, he brought the funk and the bebop, you know. Just a bad cat. Played a lot with Milt Jackson. And the first time I saw Mickey Roker play, my dad took me to a Jazzmobile concert in the summer in Harlem, right around the block from my grandmother's house. In fact, that was the day. All right, so it was my first day at Music and Art High School, and I'm supposed to meet the jazz instructor, the person who's teaching a jazz band. And I'd never met anybody like this cat. You know, he had a crisp white shirt, these octagon glasses, some blue high water bell bottoms with bold white stripes and brown Chelsea boots, kind of floor shine Chelsea boots, square toe. I'll never forget how he looked. He was just cool.
He had a vibe.
He is right? Such a vibe. He said, I'm saying, like, who is this cat, right? So later that day, I leave, you know, because that's when Music and Art was in Harlem. So on 135th Street and Compton Avenue. So I meet the cat, and then I leave the school and go to my grandmother's house, which was 158th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue. My dad comes home, meets me there, and then he takes me around to the block to see Dizzy Gillespie's big band. And you know, I'm a kid. I'm going right up to the front of the bandstand. I want to see what's happening, you know. And I see the drummer has some Fibes drums. It's the first time I ever seen Fibes drums. And they were the finish was like a kind of a, almost like a violet, kind of Naugahyde suede type of finish. It was like this weird, I didn't even know they could do this with drums. It was wild. It almost looked like AstroTurf, like violet AstroTurf, but it was like wild. And then I look up in the trumpet section and I see my teacher who I had just met that afternoon. I said, and it was Lee Morgan. So Lee Morgan was in play with Dizzy's big band that summer. And that was the summer, that was the year he was assassinated. So I got to meet Lee Morgan, and that's when I first saw Mickey Roker play. Later, I became friends with Mickey Roker. I met him a few times. Now, I wouldn't say we were friends, but acquaintances through the late great Bob Cranshaw. And then, of course, another drummer that I didn't talk about because it wasn't really applicable to this record, Beat Odyssey, but the greatest big band drummer of all time, which is Sonny Payne, who's a huge, I mean, I just think he's the best, you know. I mean, the way he played with Count Basie's big band under Quincy Jones's arrangements, nothing like it, nothing like it. He doesn't get the credit that he deserves, or he doesn't have the notoriety, because he never had his own big band like Buddy Rich and Louis Belson and Gene Krupa and blah, blah, blah. But man, hands down, for my money,
he would have changed the world, man. His play I couldn't agree with you more. What an underrated and under-acknowledged, huge, huge drummer he is in history.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody was doing what – I mean – and besides these phenomenal, unparalleled drum solos that you can Google online, which are just ridiculous, forget about that. If he never took a drum solo in his life, the way he propels that Count Basie orchestra, his sound, his groove, you talk about a pocket. Oh, Lord, this man's groove is so deep. And the way he pushes that band, oh, it's just, it's hard. It's really, you know, it's something. I get teary eyed, you know, talking about Sonny Payne, you know. Yeah, so
I'm so glad, Steve. I'm so glad you brought up his significance and importance, because really, there needs to be so much more awareness and so much more discussion and analysis and inspiration drawn from becoming aware of his playing, because everybody knows Buddy, everybody knows Gene, everybody knows Louie, everybody's got to know Sonny. He's on the same level, as you said.
He's on the same level. I put him at number one because, you know, look, Buddy Rich was phenomenal. I got to meet Buddy. He was so sweet to me. It was unbelievable. He was always up on I met him when I was like 18, 18, 19. I just gotten a job for Saturday Night Live, and Frank Eppolito, who ran Pro Percussion, he would always have somebody in his office, and he'd look through the glass, and if he saw somebody he liked, he would wave him into the office and come in. It was usually Papa Joe Jones sitting in the office drinking a Heineken or something like that, and this day it was Buddy Rich, and Frank saw me, he waved me in. And Frank introduced me to Buddy. He said, this kid's the new drummer for Saturday Night Live. And Buddy said, I know, sounds good and everything. I just could not believe it. I was in shock, you know.
Steve, how old were you when you started Saturday Night Live? You were young.
19.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
A lot of history.
Yeah. So, Buddy didn't say I sucked, you know. So it was like. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that would crush somebody.
Yeah, right. You know, he said, no, he liked the way I played. He knew who I was. I mean, it was crazy. But, it was pretty wild, you know. But I love Gene Krupa's playing. I love Willie. See, like Louis Belson, I love Louis Belson's sound. I love Louis Belson. I think of all of those three drummers that we're talking about, Louis Belson had the best sound. He was playing Rogers drums. At the time, his drum sounded impeccable. There was his tuning, the snare drum, the whole thing, beautiful sound. Buddy sounded to me like he never cared what his drum sounded like. Actually,
He used to say it wasn't about the drums, it was about the player. And I remember one time he came out on Johnny Carson with a folding chair, and he just opened the folding chair and played on the folding chair, and it was still great.
Absolutely. We've seen Buddy play on the Tonight Show numerous times, playing different drums. And he always had a different endorsement. If he wasn't playing Slinging, he was playing Lover. He wasn't playing this, he was playing that. You know, it didn't matter what he played. But sometimes they just sounded like, you know, like obviously he didn't put a key to anything. He just he played whatever. Sometimes it sounded like that, you know. And then Gene Krupa had a classic Radio King sound, you know, that kind of thing. It was a beautiful sound, you know. But Louis, to me, had the best sound of the three of them, but Sonny Payne's sound and his groove, everything to me was superior to all three of them. I mean, you know, So
this is a good lesson.
Hopefully they'll get the recognition. And then, of course, I don't know, one last thing of the article, I'm not really sure if Ken really talked about the influences of the James Brown greats, you know, William Bow, Dollar Bowman, Nate Jones, of course, my friends, Clyde Stubblefield and Jabbo Starks, and Melvin Parker, you know, so incredible influence on me, all of those guys. And then, you know, of course, we all know about what the influence Benny Benjamin had on me. But Uriel Jones and Pistol Allen had an equal effect. Sometimes I thought I was listening to Benny Benjamin, but it wasn't. It was Uriel Jones and Pistol Allen, you see, because that's the whole thing. You don't know who played on what. You never saw the credits. You had to discern the stuff on your own. And then last but not least, the great Roger Hawkins, who played in Muscle Shoals. I mean, Lord, I mean, the records he played, I get goosebumps the way he played on Mustang Sally and on Land of a Thousand Dances. And
the Staples singles, right? I'll Take You There.
I'll Take You There, you know, he and David Hood. I mean, Jesus, what a bass and drum combination on that record, you know. So I listen to a lot of people. I've ended up becoming friends with some of my heroes, which is always a mind-blowing thing. But, all of these people influence you until you come up with your own thing, you know, so.
Well, Steve, these names that you're sharing with everyone who inspired you, I really encourage everybody listening to this and watching this to go out and check out, Google these names, go on YouTube, listen and watch these drummers and these greats. You mentioned Sonny Payne's solos because his solos are unparalleled, but his playing is on the same level of his solos. But, you know, people just have no idea what's really there and what there is to learn from these guys until they go and check them out the way you did, the way all three of us did here today, by the hard way. Right. Because when I was coming up, I was going to Looney Tunes in Boston and just going through whatever records they got in that day and having to discover things and going up to the guy at the counter and saying, can you put this on so I can hear if I want to buy it or check it out or not, or go
absolutely
to the library. I mean, this is like, you know, nowadays it's so easy to find these drummers and you're giving everybody the gold. Now just go and check them out.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, there's so many people to check out, you know, people, you know, I can, the list goes on and on. I mean, people like Gaylord Birch, he was a wonderful West Coast drummer. I love the way he played, you know. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I could be talking all day and all night about all the amount of players I listen to that influenced me. So,
like David said, this is a great lesson because even myself, I learned about Mickey Rocca. So, you know, now I'm going to dive into him. And
yeah,
absolutely. So before we go, I know Ken mentioned a bunch of songs that you played on, and you've played on so many hit songs and so many great songs that produced so much stuff. I mean, God bless you. Your career is just amazing. But we did want to mention the Alicia Keys. Her big hit, if I Ain't Got You, that was one. And then Don't Get Me Wrong, The Pretenders, that was right. Another one that people, and then one that I didn't even know, because I thought it was only Leo Adam in on that one, was the Escape, the Rupert Holmes Pina Colada song, which yeah. I don't agree with, but they say that is the worst song ever recorded. It's like they did some poll one time and they said that was the corniest and worst song ever recorded, and I love that song.
Well, here's a funny story about that. We tracked it to a different set of lyrics. The original lyrics were people need other people. Da, 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 da. That's what it was. So it was kind of like a hippie kind of love song, kind of, you know, like a thing. And then lo and behold, a year or two later, whatever, the song comes out. It's got a completely different thing. And it goes to number one. It was just completely wild. And because it's a freaking, it's a story song.
It's a movie. What, it's like a movie.
It's a like a movie. And I remember first time hearing it, and like, where's he going with this? You know what I mean? Lyrically, you know, and why, you know, and you know, who knows what we would have played if the lyrics were different? You know what I mean? Who knows? But yeah, I remember the session well because it was at a studio that no longer exists, in Radio City Music Hall. There was a studio upon like the sixth floor.
Wow.
And I think they used to do a lot of recording of, you know, when the NBC Orchestra played on a stage at Radio City, they used to do a lot of stuff. So anyway, we recorded, the place was, you know, really on its last legs when we recorded it. You know, I think that's how he got the time. Was like the studio time was dirt cheap. So we ended up getting there. I remember it was like dust and cobwebs and all kinds of stuff. And Leo and Damien had just gotten a new set of Tama drums. Because he really, you know, he was digging on the Police and he liked the sound of the drums. So I had this kit. I was just a kid. I didn't know, like a lot of the guys would send their trap cases around in New York, you know, they had two and three trap, you know, you'd see Chris Parker's trap case or Steve Gadd's trap case or Bernard Purdy's trap case. You know, they had two and three trap cases all over the city. So to go from one session to another, I didn't have a trap case. I would just play whatever was there. That was my thing. And sometimes there wasn't a snare drum. I remember doing a session where they didn't have a snare drum because the drummers would bring their own snares and cymbals. So I would bring a cymbal, but never my own snare. So I had to do a session once with no snare drum. And it was like, fine. I was like, okay, let's make it work. You know, backbeats on the tom-tom, let's go. It's the 70s, you know? So anyway, the drums that were there at the studio were not very good. I mean, they, you know, they were not very good. So Leo, he was so sweet. He said, why don't you play my drums on this? I'll play the other kid. You play these drums because I want you to play these drums. So I was like, okay, you know. So, yeah, so that was the first.
And Leo,
I played his Tama drums on that track.
Leo's another one who's very underrated. A lot of people don't know about.
Leo and Damien, I learned, first of all, Leo and Damien, I learned a lot from Leo outside of the drums, actually. But he was the first person that I heard play live that sounded like he was in the studio. In other words, the way he tuned the drums and the sound that he got from his drums sounded like he was in a recording studio, not like brash and weird sounding and whatever. And, you know, so basically, and I never forgot that. And that's why I do what I do. It's evolved into that's what I do when I play live and I'm switching snare drums or whatever, because it sets the tone for everybody, not only to the listener, but the people who are playing. I mean, right. You know, and it creates a sound that you go, you got identified with. It puts you in the mood, it puts you in the right place, it inspires you, whatever. And not only for me, but everybody else listening in the band. So he was the first person that I really started getting into tuning very early because of him. I knew there were sounds that I already loved. I've been collecting records since I was 2 years old. So recording was my thing from before I even knew what recording was. But to see it actually implemented in person by a person, he was the first guy that I thought, oh wow. That's interesting. How do you do that? And that's when I started really going after sound. So Leo was key to that. You know,
Shout out to Leo. See, he's another person everybody should check out. I think we're going to have Leo on eventually.
That'd be great. That'd be great because he did a lot of stuff. There's another, you know, he was playing with Robert Palmer at one time in his road band. And
a lot of people not familiar with him.
Yeah. Another drummer that a lot of people aren't familiar with, who's a huge influence on me too, was Funky George Brown from the original Kool & the Gang.
Right.
I love Funky George's playing. He's still in Kool & the Gang, but he hasn't played drums in years. He plays keyboards in Kool & the Gang now. So kind of like how, Johnson from Earth, Wind & Fire stopped playing drums and played percussion.
Oh, Ralph. Ralph. Right.
Yeah, you know.
Did he play on Jungle?
And Freddie White. I mean, talking about drummers in Earth, Wind & Fire, I mean, besides the great Maurice White, who played as a studio musician in Chicago, you have Ralph playing. But then when Freddie White joined, I mean, I love Freddie White's playing. I mean, if anybody doesn't know who Freddie White is, you need to check out Donnie Hathaway Live and hear the combination of Freddie White and Willie Weeks, and that'll change your day.
Wow. Well, we could definitely go on forever and ever. And
we will actually. We're going to have Steve back because there's just so much to catch up on and talk about. And Steve, you've been an inspiration since I heard you and saw you with the Blues Brothers. And
Thank you.
Literally day one, man, just the energy and the tastefulness and the pocket of your playing combined with incredible chops and musical ability all the way to last year. I get the deluxe reissue of Talk Is Cheap. And it's like, so everywhere I go, I'm being inspired by you. Oh,
thank you. Yeah, that was a fun record to make. I really, you know, that was a really important period, and it goes on today because I love Keith and he's like a big brother, so that's great.
Yeah, there's some talks about maybe putting that band back together, right?
Well, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, with the situation going on and you know, obviously the Stones are going to be touring, so we'll see, but time will tell. But Keith and I are always in contact and making music one way or the other.
And one last thing before we go, how's Megan and what's happening with the Verbs? We're going to hear a new...
We are working on Garage Sale, which will be our fourth album. I'm very excited. She's writing up a storm as usual, but it's going to be a raw experience. And I'm really, really excited about it. JV Records has some good product coming out this year, so I'm very excited. Garage Sale.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much. Everybody, check this out. Look up those names that we were talking about today, and that's a lesson in itself. Steve, as always, thank you so much for taking the time. I know how busy you are. We'll see you sometime soon, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone.